A warning for listeners. This episode contains brief mentions of violence, sexual assault, and drug use. It's Oktoberfest weekend in La Crosse, Wisconsin. The small city along the Mississippi River is bursting with energy. People have made their way from the parade to the fest grounds, where you don't have to be German to show off your finest lederhosen, pretzel necklaces, and beer steins. In between the polka sets, some local bands take the stage, like Mr. Blink. Mr. Blink has been a La Crosse music scene staple for more than 30 years. And for a lot of that time, Enrique Moret has played percussion with the group, energizing songs with congas and the tambourine.
I always play with Mr. Blink because I like to play music too much.
If you've seen live music in La Crosse any time over the last 40 years, you've likely seen Enrique play. Outside of Mr. Blink, the 69-year-old has filled in with different bands, played open mic nights, and showed up to impromptu jams.
For many years, Enrique worked in the media center at Gunderson Hospital. He has roots in La Crosse. His circle of friends goes beyond the city's music scene.
Wisconsin is his home.
Enrique Pazo More.
And you live here in La Crosse?
I live in La Crosse longer than Cuba.
But it didn't feel much like home when he first got here, when he was one of the few Cubans to settle in La Crosse after arriving in 1980.
Because now, only Enrique fly in the milk.
Yes, Enrique refers to himself as a fly in the milk.
Yes, and that's a Cuban saying. What he means is he's the only black guy in a sea of white people.
Because when the weekend was a few Cuba, then nobody could see it. But now, ooh.
Enrique came to the U.S. during the Mario boat lift.
For 5 months in 1980, the Cuban government opened its borders. During that time, nearly 125,000 residents left Cuba for the United States.
Boats were leaving all day yesterday, into the night, and more will be leaving early this morning. And it's expected that some boats will return today with more refugees.
And Enrique was one of the 15,000 migrants who were temporarily housed at Fort McCoy in the small western Wisconsin town of Sparta.
I've casually known Enrique for about 15 years. I used to bartend at the Popcorn Tavern in La Crosse, where he's played music for decades. I'd ask him what it was like to leave his life in Cuba behind, to be sent to live on a military base in a completely new country, surrounded by strangers, only some of them speak your language, unable to leave on your own. Every time I'd ask him about this experience, he'd say, "The past is the past. I don't like talking about the past." But now, he's opening up.
Soy Omar Granados.
And I'm Maureen McCollum. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Uprooted. The story of the Mariel boat lift and the Cuban refugees at Fort McCoy has fascinated me for years. I wanted to do a story on the 40th anniversary of the Mariel boat lift for WPR's Wisconsin Life Project back in 2020. So I reached out to you, Omar. You introduced me to a number of Cubans living in La Crosse, guys that will be appearing on this podcast.
Yes, I grew up in Havana, Cuba, and I have a very vague memory of the Mariel boat lift. I was 5 years old when it happened. I moved to La Crosse about 9 years ago, and I'm now a professor of Spanish and Latin American studies at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse. I never thought I'd have Cuban neighbors when I moved here to La Crosse, but once I learned there was a community of Mariel refugees here, I did want to know more about them and eventually wanting to help them share their stories through community conversations and a traveling photo exhibit.
And that's how we connected after you and I first met and I interviewed some of those Mariel refugees. I realized this was an impossible story to tell in just a few minutes, so a podcast was born.
And in this podcast, Uprooted, we'll be covering a lot of ground. Personal stories, history, politics, immigration, racism, media coverage, and how all these forces impacted the lives of some of our neighbors.
At the heart of this project are the Cuban refugees themselves, like Enrique and his friends in La Crosse and Madison. These are guys who have become family to one another because of their time at Fort McCoy. They came to Wisconsin as young men in 1980. They weren't necessarily welcomed with open arms, but they've stayed here, and now they're all in their 60s. So what were their lives like in Cuba? How has life been in Wisconsin? Will they ever get to go home again? Now let's get back to Enrique Morey. I met him at a park in La Crosse where he told me about his younger years in Cuba. Enrique grew up in Havana. When he was young, he wanted to play violin and flute, but people steered him toward the drums.
They say, you can be a percussionist guarantee. But I play the timpani. That's where I play. He was teaching me.
Music was in his blood. Enrique says he's related to the famous Cuban musician Benny Morey. Outside of music, he played soccer. He was a good student. Enrique was the oldest child, and he was close with his family.
Everything, I did have a very good life in Cuba. My mother was very good.
And then in 1959, the Cuban Revolution took place and Fidel Castro rose to power.
Enrique was a kid at the time, but as he grew, he saw the revolution affect nearly every part of his life, and he didn't always like what he saw.
When I was in another province, that's where they accused me to run them out against Castro.
Enrique had been speaking out against Castro's communist government. He had a few reasons. For example, he says the Cuban government took away a home that had been gifted to him. And then there was an incident involving beer.
There was a bunch of the middle-aged people that doesn't like to drink. And then we buy the food and the beer for them. They eat the food, we drink the beer. Then some woman decided we couldn't do it. And they are beginning to run them out.
Wait, Omar, can you help us understand why Enrique Morey got in trouble for drinking other people's beers at a restaurant?
So when I listened to the story, what I remember is that during the 1970s, there was all sorts of strict regulations and rations and rules in terms of what you could get at a store or a restaurant. You could go to a restaurant and order alcohol only if you were eating. And I think that's what's happening here. I think Enrique was trying to drink beer and he was only able to get the beer once you bought the fish. And then he was probably giving the fish away. So the manager or administrator of this restaurant probably didn't approve of him buying extra beers. And let's remember there is a system of surveillance of Cuban citizens in place at the time. So all of a sudden you have a black man who's had probably a few beers, and that is something that caught the attention of the police.
All right, so in the fallout of the beer exchange and criticizing Castro, Enrique ended up in jail.
But I believe there was 1 year, 6 months, and 1 day.
And this is where things could have gone very differently for Enrique. If the following series of events didn't happen, it's pretty likely that Enrique's life would be much different. He would have never ended up in Wisconsin, never established roots in La Crosse, and never played with his band, Mr. Blink, on stage at Oktoberfest. When Enrique was in his mid-20s, sitting in prison in 1980, a group of people hundreds of miles away stormed the Peruvian embassy in Havana, demanding asylum so they could leave Cuba. About 10,000 people eventually showed up and wanted to leave, including Enrique's brother.
And this was one of the many embassy breaches that were happening mostly in the city of Havana in the late years of 1970s because of the discontent that folks in Cuba were expressing towards Castro's mostly economic policies.
But it was the Peruvian embassy break-in that triggered the beginning of the Mariel boatlift.
Thousands of Cubans have flooded the embassy compound of Peru, hoping to get out of the country. Even after 20 years of socialistic indoctrination, much dissatisfaction exists.
U.S. President Jimmy Carter agreed to take in 3,500 refugees from the Peruvian embassy.
We, as a nation, have always had our arms open to receiving refugees in accordance with American law. We'll continue to provide an open heart and open arms to refugees seeking freedom from communist domination and from economic deprivation brought about primarily by Fidel Castro and his government.
And Castro didn't like this move from Carter. Remember, we're at the height of the Cold War. Castro actually goes on national television and tells Cubans that they are free to leave, suggesting also to Cuban Americans, mostly in South Florida, that they can come pick up their relatives in Cuba. So in a way, Carter's reaction actually sets up the perfect plan for Castro, who then starts getting rid of people that he doesn't want in Cuba. He starts opening prisons and psychiatric hospitals. And there are theories that a large number of Cuban spies also come to the United States via the Mariel Exodus.
And while Carter's message welcoming Cuban refugees was making the rounds, Enrique Moray caught wind of it while in prison. It actually inspired him to leave.
One day was when the Carter said, that sent to Castro, and Castro said, how many do you want? I saw that opportunity, I said, go.
He talked it over with his mother, who supported his decision to leave.
And it's right around this time that Castro is making sensational appearances on TV, using very inflammatory language like gusano, a worm, and escoria, scum, to describe the people that are leaving through Mariel. This inspires Cubans to start turning on people who want to go, creating yet another obstacle for people like Enrique, who are trying to leave.
Enrique encountered those protesters during his bus ride to the port of Mariel. Soon after he arrived at the port, he boarded a boat with 11 other people. The trip across the Florida Straits to Key West was treacherous.
It was bad, bad, bad weather.
Oh, okay.
Bad, bad weather. We, in the middle of the night, we was ready to go. When I swear to God, there was like a 22 feet over.
The yes, waves?
Yes.
Holy
yes,
moly.
A lot of people didn't make it. Because if you fall down, no, there's no time to come and pick you out.
Luckily, everyone on his boat made it through. But that wasn't the case for other Cubans making the journey. Some fell overboard because of the waves, or because they had history with some bad people.
Some enemy throw the people in the boat. Oh. Because coming from, they have a problem in prison.
Finally, Enrique's boat approached land.
I arrived in Key West at 2:45. Never forgot.
The details are a little fuzzy on what happens next. As Enrique got off the boat, he had to navigate a somewhat chaotic scene where he was processed by volunteers and U.S. government officials. He says the captain of the boat was going to help him find his aunt, but then he came across someone handing out apples and using them as a religious offering. He was drawn in, but in that moment, he got separated from the captain.
When they come in, the guy said, they were looking for you.
So you lost them.
Well, they had to go because they were looking for me.
Okay.
And then the guy said, well, no, he went down there with these three women.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if you would have stayed with them, you potentially wouldn't have gone to Fort McCoy?
Yeah.
Whoa. That one little moment completely changed the trajectory of your life.
Just a few hours later, Enrique Moray was boarding a plane in the middle of the night to fly to Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin. He arrived June 3rd, 1980. Enrique became one of the nearly 15,000 Cuban refugees to go to Fort McCoy. You may be wondering, why were a bunch of Cuban refugees in southern Florida suddenly being flown to Wisconsin? To put it simply, they were running out of space and homes for all the refugees in cities like Key West and Miami. The government had to find a place to keep people temporarily before they found permanent homes with families or sponsors.
Fort McCoy was an Army Reserve and National Guard training base, which had been prepared for the arrival of the more than 14,000 Cubans on extremely short notice from FEMA. It was the last of four camps to open to house Mariel refugees. The camp had been set up with much more police and wire fencing because of riots that had happened in other camps at Fort Chaffee in Arkansas.
Officials of relief agencies working at Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, say the main reason for last week's rioting by the Cubans being held there was boredom. The exiles sit and wait with little to do until they can be relocated. Steve Proctor.
By June 23rd, in 1980, the Cuban refugee population at Fort McCoy had peaked at more than 13,000. Approximately 90% of that population was male, and the great majority were unskilled between the ages and 25 and 35 years old with no English skills.
So Enrique says his experience at Fort McCoy was interesting. He worked in the visitor center and genuinely enjoyed the food. He played music, and he tried to have fun passing the time while living in the barracks.
Party.
Yeah. Like play music or?
Party.
Party, party.
Because them. What do they call it? The MP. The people in the army.
Oh, yeah. The MPs?
The military folks? People that work there? They just like bring in beer or?
Beer. Beer was in the bar in Fort McCoy.
Okay. Oh, I didn't realize there was a bar in there.
Yes, there
was.
Sounds like it was an unsanctioned underground speakeasy bar of sorts where people were low-key drinking to pass the time.
Cubans who grew up in the revolution had been really good at living with limitations for decades. Enrique wanted to party, and he figured out how to do it. And Enrique and all the other Cubans are trying to continue a way of life from back home at Fort McCoy.
Enrique was also hoping to get connected with a sponsor so he could leave Fort McCoy as soon as possible. Omar, what exactly does that mean?
Cubans who came in the Mariel boat lift had a very specific immigration designation, which was entrance with status pending. And what that meant was that they needed to secure sponsors who would agree to help them resettle in the community. Now, most Mariel refugees who arrived in Key West during the first 2 weeks of Mariel really benefited from the direct work of voluntary organizations and were able to resettle quickly in Miami and Florida. But those who were sent to Arkansas, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, however, did not have the same fortune. So many Black and homosexual Marielitos had ventured out of Cuba unexpectedly or had been forced to join in the boat lift. The entrance status pending designation put them in a very grim spot as it required them to be paroled out of the camps under a sponsor they did not know yet.
Okay, so the sooner Enrique found a sponsor, the sooner he could get out of Fort McCoy, a place that he says could be pretty scary at times. He tried to avoid confrontation, but stood up for himself if someone threatened him.
Because they was scary in there.
In
Fort McCoy.
Yeah, just the people some of the people in general, or like the people working?
People, because they coming from prison, they have a lot of enemy.
Sure.
Enrique does not like to go into details about his time at Fort McCoy.
I don't want to even remember.
Yeah.
This was a Wild West.
Yeah.
Wild West.
I mentioned earlier that I've been trying to get Enrique to talk with me about Fort McCoy for years. This is the most he's opened up to me.
And it's typical. I've also encountered with Cuban guys in La Crosse. They don't want to talk too much about their time at Fort McCoy. And I think it's related to the trauma that they've experienced. Some have just forgotten about it. And honestly, I don't think there is a common thread, since all of them may have had different experiences at the fort. Let's not forget that this happened 42 years ago, and that's how memory works.
So Enrique finally left Fort McCoy after 3 months. He found a sponsor who he still considers a mother figure. Over the decades, he's formed strong relationships with people in La Crosse and found family within the city's music scene, especially with his chosen brothers and sister in Mr. Blink. But it wasn't always easy for Enrique or many of the other Mariel refugees who came to the U.S. While President Carter initially accepted the Cubans with an open heart and open arms, they weren't necessarily welcomed in their communities, in La Crosse, in Sparta, and even down in Florida.
For the Cuban American community, they would be known as the Marielitos. Many of these new refugees were young, black men and had been labeled as criminals by the Cuban government.
After the break, we'll hear from a teenager who was sent to Fort McCoy without his family, or so he thought. You're listening to Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Bridget Bowden, podcast host for WPR Reports. If you're enjoying Uprooted, then join me and Sean Johnson for Derailed. It's an investigative podcast about all the twists and turns in Wisconsin's saga for passenger rail. We tell the story of how the project came together, how it fell apart, and how it changed the state. To subscribe and find more, visit WPR.org/derailed or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Maureen McCollum, host of WPR Reports, Uprooted. I'm passionate about storytelling. Stories give us an opportunity to understand another person's experience. They help shape, reinforce, or challenge our views and values. Member support made today's powerful narrative possible. Bring tomorrow's stories to life with your gift now at WPR.org/donate. In 1980, nearly 15,000 Cuban refugees were sent to live at Fort McCoy in Sparta, Wisconsin, during the Mariel boatlift. About 300 of them were minors, living without their family and under the custody of the state. People like Armando Rodriguez, who now lives in Madison, Wisconsin. So how did Armando, who was just a 16-year-old kid back in 1980, get here? Back in Havana, Cuba, Armando was hanging out with his friends one day.
En Cuba, estaba yo en una esquina fumando marihuana con unos amigos míos.
In Cuba, I was on a corner smoking marijuana with some friends of mine, and the police came and picked us up, and they sent us to juvenile prison. So I was already close to political problems. And we didn't have a lot of marijuana. It was just a joint, as they called it, a little cigarette. And that was the last day that I smoked marijuana. And after that day, I went many years without smoking marijuana because every time I smoke marijuana, I am reminded of the separation of my family. Today, I don't smoke.
3.5 years in juvenile detention for smoking a joint.
In its effort to build a perfect socialist society, the Cuban government was particularly strict about young people's social behavior and anything that could affect their ideology. They're very concerned about the influence from the United States, so this includes smoking weed. Police also had an X-riot on young black men.
So as the Mariel boatlift was underway, Armando was sitting in juvenile detention. Cuban officials asked him if he wanted to go to the U.S.
When I left Cuba, I left sort of confused. The first time they kicked me out of Cuba, I said no. They asked me if I wanted to go to the United States, and I said no. I didn't want to leave, but later I found out my brother had left. I was young and happy. I was very happy and nervous. We arrived here in Key West, and then we arrived at Fort McCoy. In Fort McCoy, I stayed for 5 months.
En Fort McCoy, estuve 5 meses.
5 months on a military base, a world away from his home back in Havana. At Fort McCoy, he started looking for his brother, Guillermo Rodriguez. He wanted to see him, feel some sort of connection to home.
But his brother wasn't at Fort McCoy. It was another Guillermo Rodriguez.
Me dijeron que mi hermano mayor se fue para los Estados Unidos. Mm-hmm.
They told me that my brother had left for the United States. So I said, well, I'm leaving. Then when I got there, they gave me my brother's name. But my dad has the same name. Then I realized that it was my dad who had come, that it wasn't my brother. My brother had stayed in Cuba, and today he is in Cuba.
This was one of the most shocking stories of this project for me. Armando had not only taken the risk to follow the example of his brother, come to the United States, but now he found himself at Fort McCoy with his father, who he had not spoken to in years.
Once the father and son reconnected at Fort McCoy, they developed a daily routine. They'd leave their barracks and meet up at a barbed wire fence.
Yo veía a mi papá del lado allá.
I saw my dad on the other side of the fence, and we talked from afar. I had two fences, and then his fence. So there were three fences. And we spent about a month and some like that.
These tall barbed wire fences kept kids separate from the adults who were also living at the military base in Sparta. Government officials wanted to protect the children, but Armando says it felt like a prison. These meetings were a big deal for the father and son. Armando didn't have a relationship with his dad when they both lived in Havana, Cuba, just weeks earlier. Armando didn't like the way his dad treated his mother. But now, here they were, talking through a fence in Wisconsin. They were trying to find some sort of connection to home, but they couldn't even physically be near one another without this fence in the way. Despite that barrier, the meetings were an escape from the chaos, disorientation, and new language in their new home. Other than these moments with his father, Armando doesn't share a ton of details about what he encountered while in Fort McCoy. But other miners have written accounts of their experiences at the military base. In fact, the staff at the Monroe County History Room give us a stack of these letters. I want to emphasize that everyone had different experiences at Fort McCoy. These teenagers who wrote these letters experienced some of the worst treatment there, and they were hoping someone would hear their story and help them.
Some of the letters are disturbing and pretty hard to get through, like this one from Sergio Manuel Grimal Mayol, who was 17 years old.
I came to the USA June 6th, and today is August 12th. I've been here in this place 66 days.
They threatened to kill me three times.
They also stole my clothes, but the worst thing that happened to me was when two black guys threatened to kill me if I didn't have sex with them.
Find ourselves in a difficult situation.
For example, people threatened us with knives, robbed us, and molested us daily.
In the 61 days that I have been in Fort McCoy, I have witnessed the worst things I have seen in my life.
They follow me like hunting dogs.
Come to my barrack with knife in hand, trying to steal my belongings, which were
few. Sergio Armando Fernandez Nunez, August 12, 1980.
I know that most of the army, interpreters, and cooks here believe in us, as we do them.
There is a fenced-off juvenile area which has a great number of problems.
By and large, they've treated us in a humanitarian
Gilbert
way.
Araujo Rivero.
One of the MPs struck me with a club last Saturday, August 9th.
Our normal course of event in that
as a result, I have a black eye.
That would prepare themselves for a new life in this country.
My head was bleeding too.
One hit me on the head.
They keep on lying to us ever since.
But they are ready to kill
Jose
for them.
Jose Miguel Narbona Sanchez, 17 years old.
At that
old.
Moment, I jumped out of the window from the second
some
floor.
Of the evils.
Do you think it is fair?
I've never been so scared for my life.
Miguel and what's your younger brother's name?
At Satori Arts Gallery in La Crosse, Armando Rodriguez is looking through a thick stack of papers. He's not a 16-year-old trying to survive at Fort McCoy anymore. He's in his 50s and has a good job in Madison. In this moment, the normally chatty, chill guy is silent. For about 20 minutes, he's been going through this seemingly mundane stack of papers with a bunch of names and numbers. But all these documents are blowing Armando's mind. This is a list of every single Cuban refugee who came through Fort McCoy. He's reflecting on his time there. And in the midst of his search,
I found my father in Nassau Park.
You found your father?
Yeah. Guillermo Rodriguez Nande.
Can you read the rest of the line for us?
Who?
Can you, or like the name of the city and...
No, Havana.
Mm-hmm. His birthday? 1036?
But this is the number.
What does it feel like seeing your dad's name on that list?
Will.
What's that? Can I take a picture of it quick?
Omar, this was clearly an emotional moment for Armando. You could really see it in his eyes and through his silence. And to me, it seemed like he was almost reconnecting with his father, someone who he last saw at the fence at Fort McCoy in 1980.
Yes. He found his father on this book and he like really froze and he was shaking a little bit. Do you remember that? I mean, this is a 250-pound man, 6 feet tall, was shaking in front of a book. And something had like come full circle to him on what actually had happened in his life, you know, when he saw that name there. He came to Fort McCoy chasing Guillermo, the brother, and 42 years later, here was the real Guillermo, his father, on paper.
After leaving Fort McCoy, Armando's father, Guillermo Rodriguez Hernandez, was sent to New Jersey to live with a sponsor. He would later pass away. The two never saw each other again. Most Cubans who left Fort McCoy were like Armando's father. They left Wisconsin after connecting with family or finding sponsors. They went to cities like Minneapolis, New York, and even back to South Florida. But some people, like Armando, remained in southern Wisconsin, in places like La Crosse, Sparta, and Madison. They created lives here as bus drivers, fathers, and musicians. None of the people we talk with have been back to Cuba in 42 years. Many of them can't go back because of criminal convictions in the U.S. that prevent them from leaving and re-entering the country. Some people, like Enrique Morey, aren't interested in visiting Cuba anyways.
So would you ever want to go back and visit Cuba?
I can't.
You can't, but would you want to?
I don't know nobody in Cuba.
Sure.
Why did we go to Cuba? My grandma, my mother, they live longer. My grandma was... died like a few days before the 103. Her father was 108.
It would be different if his mother and grandmother were still alive, then he would want to visit them.
But most of other Mariel refugees in Wisconsin, like Armando, feel different.
I've never been able to visit Cuba. I would like to visit Cuba. I'm not allowed to go. And if I go, I can't come back. I'm in the same situation as everyone else who has committed a crime.
Yeah.
There are hundreds of Mariel refugees living in Madison, Milwaukee, and elsewhere in Wisconsin. About 30 of them live in La Crosse. They're mostly in their 60s. Many are unemployed or don't have health insurance. All they want is to go back to Cuba, but they can't. These are folks that you'll meet throughout this podcast.
If I have the chance to go back home, you know, and the person will be going to the cemetery where my mother's buried. I'm 63 years old. Wow, times go fast, you know. And I haven't given up. I have faith.
Why can those Cubans get a second chance? So they can go see the mama.
Do you want to go back and visit also?
Yeah, I want to go see my mama before she died.
I can go to Cuba.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, I can go. The only problem is when I want to do my passport, I talk to my sister to send my birth certificate. And when I see my birth certificate, that's wrong. That's not my name.
Because when I try to kill him, I always say, you know, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba.
In the next episode of Uprooted, we'll dive into the history and lives of the Cubans who came to Wisconsin in 1980 as part of the Mariel Boatlift. And we'll talk about how the Cuban Revolution in 1959 led to thousands of Cubans coming to the U.S. in 1980.
The revolution in Cuba has thrown out the Batista administration. Now the revolution must consolidate itself. The government must be organized to cope with the many, many problems that now face this country. The man upon whose strength all this depends is Dr. Fidel Castro.
Also, hear about what childhood was like in Cuba for two friends who now live together in Wisconsin.
So, did you ever win one of those races when you were a kid?
Okay, I went like three times. The first time I went like 12 because all the kids want to do it, and you can get the girl.
That's the one thing that my family taught me, to love and be kind.
That's next time on Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio. Uprooted is reported, written, and produced by me, executive producer Maureen McCollum, along with Omar Granados. Our producer and technical director is Brad Kohlberg. We're edited by Brady Carlson. Music direction and composition by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich, Peter Bryant, Hannah Haynes, Ezra Wall, Rachel Vasquez, and Bridget Bowden. Voice work by Dom Johnson and Tyler Ditter. Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand. The digital design team is Jane Jumale, Amanda Starich, and Anna Rudin. Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major. And special thanks to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse's Murphy Library for archival photos. Artwork by Grace Lorenz. Our theme music is the song Bozo Part 3 by Willie Chirino. Additional music from La Familia Valera Miranda. And Mr. Blink. Archival audio from NPR's Research, Archives, and Data Strategy team. You can see more at wpr.org/uprooted.